Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead this hour, we'll take an in-depth look at college campus policing. Some want to do away with the cops, but others say their role is vital. We'll hear from the different sides. Recreational marijuana has been legal in Illinois for over a year, and while sales have been strong, there are still concerns about racial equity. And we've now marked 1 year since the first COVID-19 case in Illinois. This doctor treated some of the first to be diagnosed.
We hardly knew anything. And over the past few months, we know how the disease progresses. We know some forms of therapy, but we still don't have very good therapy. The best thing that we have now is the vaccines coming out.
More on the lessons learned during the pandemic and the challenges that still lie ahead. That and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, we'll hear from Illinois' public health director about the latest developments in the pandemic. Also, Illinois' marijuana industry has had a strong first year of sales, but some say the state is failing in a key area, racial equity. And we take an in-depth look at campus police, their role, and why some want to see them gone. That and more this hour on Statewide. This past week marked 1 year since public health officials announced Illinois' first known case of COVID-19. Since then, the virus has devastated the state, infecting more than 1.1 million residents and taking more than 18,000 lives. Dr. Linwood Jones, an infectious disease expert with Amita Health, helped oversee the treatment of Illinois' first coronavirus patients at St. Alexius Medical Center in Hoffman Estates. He spoke with WBEZ's Melba Laura to reflect on the past year, starting with last winter.
Well, in December, we didn't know anything about coronavirus. Everybody was bracing for it, but we said, oh, it's probably going to stay in China, stay out of this country. However, in the middle of January, one of our primary care doctors had a patient who had traveled to Wuhan, China to visit their relatives, and they had come back and they were sick. And so that primary care doctor contacted our emergency room and brought the patient in to be evaluated. And so that really sent the wheels going. Everybody said, oh my gosh, we've got a possible coronavirus patient. And so the hospital really had to gear up for it.
We knew so little about the virus right at the beginning. How did you treat those first patients, and what did you end up learning?
Well, when the patients first came in, we didn't know a lot about therapy. Our first problem was how to isolate those patients so that they wouldn't spread the illness to our employees and our physicians and nurses. So all of those patients were placed in isolation, a strict isolation.
It's been hard not to be on social media and see all the reports of doctors and nurses and respiratory therapists who have just been overwhelmed by the number of sick patients that they've been seeing in the hospitals. What's it been like in the last year for your hospital?
Well, the last year has been tough on all the employees, the physicians, nurses, respiratory techs, the folks who keep our rooms clean. Everybody has been impacted. And our hospital has really risen to the occasion because everybody says that they're heroes, but people don't think that they're heroes. They're just saying they're doing their job and they're doing what they can do to help their patients. But it has been a rough time for the folks in the hospital.
And how are you feeling as we're going now into year two of this pandemic? What challenges do you see are ahead for us?
Well, I think back in March, we hardly knew anything. And over the past few months, we know how the disease progresses. We know some forms of therapy, but we still don't have very good therapy. The best thing that we have now is the vaccines coming out. And it's very impressive scientifically how fast the vaccines have come to people's arms very quickly. I've never seen this in 35 years. I haven't seen anything progress this quickly. And so that's light at the end of the tunnel.
That's Dr. Linwood Jones with Amita Health. He oversaw treatment of the first COVID-19 patients in Illinois, and he spoke with Melba Lara. Well, during the pandemic, one of the people front and center in Illinois' fight against COVID-19 has been Dr. Ngozi Ezike. She's director of Illinois' Department of Public Health. And she spoke this week with WSIU's Jennifer Fuller.
In the 1 year since COVID-19 arrived in Illinois, you had a message just at the start of this week saying that you didn't want to have another 1 year marker where you talked about thousands of lives lost and perhaps another tens of thousands of infections. Do you think that we're moving in the right direction at this point?
Of course, right now, all the metrics for every single region of the state is moving in the right direction, but that was under intense mitigations. And so the reward for things moving in the right direction is that we get to loosen some of those mitigations and those restrictions. But as has happened already, as we open up, sometimes we go too far and then we end up back up the path of increasing cases and increasing hospitalizations. And so I want us to learn from before. We want to continue to have the ability to do some things that, you know, give us joy, but we have to do it responsibly so that we won't have to revert back because of increasing cases, which of course means increased hospitalizations and more deaths. So we want to do this the right way. The vaccines are already on the ground, and although they're not enough, you know, that is helping us get towards the finish line. But there's action that we have to take, and this mask cannot not leave our sight, leave our face. It has to stay over our nose and mouth.
It's probably, I'm sure, a very delicate balance when you decide to move from mitigation back into, say, phase four of the recovery and perhaps having to go back into those mitigations. Can you talk a little bit about that process? A lot of people were a little concerned that it perhaps moved too fast over the last week or so.
The issue is that people have been doing well for a while, but because we were up against New Year's and thinking that signaling that things were open right before New Year's might cause super spreader events all throughout the state associated with trying to finally put 2020 in the rearview mirror and ring in 2021. So we wanted to wait for some time, make sure that, you know, there wasn't any kind of significant resurgence from the holiday, the extended holiday period, and make sure that those gains we saw would be sustained. And they were 2 weeks after New Year's. So we have been on this correct trajectory for a while now. It's just a matter of not reversing it as we have more activity in our restaurants, as we have activity associated with sports, as we have increased capacity, as new venues are open, casinos, et cetera. So we just have to guard this very carefully. I feel like anyone getting sick, you know, at this point is even somehow even more sad when we're just so close. And so we really have to protect all of our health, all our community's health, by doing these simple things. And this mask is so underrated, but it's so powerful. This is the tool we have while we're rolling out this slow trickle of vaccines.
You mentioned vaccine and you mentioned masks, and that's right where I wanted to go next. People are still hearing, well, I'm going to go ahead and get this shot. That means that basically the doors open wide for me. But you and other experts are saying, no, you still need to make sure that you're wearing your mask, you're keeping your distance, and you're washing your hands. Can you talk a little bit about the science behind that?
Right. So we understand that we are in a disaster situation. This is an emergency situation. And so these vaccines, you know, which were monitored for 2 months, we know definitively that they cut back on disease. What we don't know and what is still being studied is if you can still be asymptomatic, carrying the disease, not being ill, and still pass it on. And so given that those answers need to be clarified and confirmed, there's a potential that vaccinated, you stay safe and don't get ill, but still could transmit the virus to others who could get sick and much worse. And so we need to continue with our masking. We need to do it universally. It really only, we only get the full benefit when everyone is doing it. So we have to stay true to these masks, wear them even more than ever, especially as we think about these additional new, essentially more dangerous variants that are already in our state and the states around us.
Can you talk a little bit about those variants? A lot of people are hearing in the news the UK variant, that we're starting to hear more about a variant coming out of South Africa. And then of course there are variants that we're identifying here in the United States. They may be more contagious. They may cause more serious illness. What are you most concerned about?
All of that and then some. Obviously, we know that just the variant that we're familiar with here, you know, has caused the nearly 19,000 deaths that we've seen and still logging, unfortunately, more names to that list every single day. And so if the current variant has a competitor that wants to do more, i.e. infect more individuals and have those individuals that get sick have a worse outcome, like that is bad news. So we are fighting against that. And the same tools that we've been talking about now, you know, for a year are the same ones that will protect us against any of these variants that are out there. And it's this masking, but it needs to be an all-in community effort, an all-in Illinois effort, every single person wearing it to protect themselves and others. And I don't know how much clearer to say it, but this is going to be the key thing that every individual can do. And for the most part, we have been, but if we can raise that level up more than where we are, we will be able to stay ahead of this variant, hopefully for as long as possible, and allow more of our businesses and our economy to stay open. But if we don't, we know what works. You know, we know that having mitigations slows the process down, but it can also be contained and maintained with the mask. And I would rather do it with the masking than having to revert back to tighter restrictions.
That's Dr. Ngozi Ezike, the director of Illinois' Department of Public Health, as she spoke with Jennifer Fuller. Lawyers representing some of the families who lost relatives after a COVID outbreak at the LaSalle Veterans Home are preparing to file a lawsuit. Juan Pablo Ramirez Franco tells us more about one of those families.
Lindsay, how long did it take from the moment you found out he had the virus for him to succumb to it?
About 10 days.
Lindsay Lamb's grandfather, Richard Seske Sr., died in November. He was one of the more than 30 residents at the LaSalle Veterans Home to contract COVID-19 and die from the outbreak there. Lamb says she was close to her grandfather.
He was a big schmoozer. He was a big flirt. He was a big family man. His family was everything to him. His wife was everything to him.
About 7 years ago, Seske's health started to decline. He had dementia. When it became too much to care for him on their own, the family decided that Richard move to the veterans' home. Seske's wife, Bernie, came to visit him every day. She'd help him get ready for meals and spend time with him. But Lamb says that stopped when the state went into lockdown due to the COVID-19 pandemic. It wasn't until June that Seske's family could come visit him. And when they did, the visits had a window between them.
He didn't understand why my grandma couldn't, you know, show any affection towards him and couldn't hug him or touch him. And he started to think that, like, we didn't love him anymore.
Lamb says the 7 months leading up to Seske's death were lonely for him. But Lamb says her grandpa was lucky because the nurses and the nursing assistants had a soft spot for him. Around the beginning of November, Lindsay Lamb says her mom, Leslie Lamb, got a text message to check on him.
So I called the nurse's station and they said they were just down there and he was fine. And I said, okay. So then we got the FaceTime. He appeared to have a stroke. I mean, it was heartbreaking because he couldn't talk.
So Mom, we hung up with him, of course, and Mom called the nurse's station again and asked that the in-house doctor go visit him and check him out because we knew that something was wrong.
So she went down there and then she called me back and said that, yes, he has tested positive for COVID and they were going to move him to the COVID wing then.
Saskia was in the COVID-19 wing for about a week. Then his family got the call.
And the doctor that mom just referred to had called back and said, you know, he's close. So you need to come and say your goodbyes.
And I brought a bottle of Windex and paper towels to wipe the window down so we could see him clearly. And we made a poster that says, we love you, Dad. And we signed everybody's names. And to our surprise, we were expecting to go and, you know, say our goodbyes. And he was sitting up in his wheelchair, flirting with the nurses, laughing, joking with us, calling us all by our nicknames. More concerned with the fact that we were outside in the cold and not in there with him.
After he saw all of us, he passed away in the middle of the night. So I think he was waiting for all of us to come and see him.
Long-term care facilities have been particularly hard hit. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker noted the work ahead.
Look, what we want to do is restore confidence that people have in our Veterans Affairs Department, and we want to do our best to take care of our veterans.
The outbreak and deaths at the facility prompted the Illinois Senate Veterans Affairs Committee to call for virtual hearings in November. Some of the findings included staff not wearing personal protective equipment or practicing social distancing, and sanitizer at the front entrance that wasn't alcohol-based. Isabel Bassador is a lawyer for Seski's family. She says negative pressure rooms used to isolate patients from airborne disease weren't being utilized appropriately.
They found that the doors were kept open because they said that, well, some of these residents are fall risks and the risk outweighed the benefit of keeping these doors open.
In December, amid outrage over the handling of the outbreak at the LaSalle Veterans Home, Governor Pritzker fired the director of the facility. Then earlier this month, the head of the Illinois Department of Veterans Affairs, Linda Chapalavia, resigned. For Lindsay Lamb, it's hard to think about the months her granddad spent relatively alone.
I understand that, unfortunately, that, you know, what happens with this virus, but I think that is what gets to us the most, is that he was alone.
The law firm representing Siski's family says they're currently representing 16 different families who lost relatives at the facility. I'm Juan Pablo Ramirez Franco.
We have more of Statewide coming up. Stay right here. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The rollout of the coronavirus vaccine provides hope that the end of the pandemic is near, but it's not over yet. And in some parts of the country, access to COVID-19 testing is still a problem. Christine Herman looks at efforts to address the issue for agricultural workers in a small town.
For more than a decade, 35-year-old Sarai has been a farm worker. She spends much of the summer and fall cultivating corn and soybeans in the fields of central Illinois. She asked we not use her last name since she's undocumented.
Ser un trabajador agrícola es lo más bonito.
Sarai says being a farm worker is the most beautiful thing. She hasn't been in the fields lately since she's been focused on getting 3 kids through virtual schooling. But she says the past year has been devastating to many agricultural workers who've been struck by the virus. Last fall, Sarai decided to get a coronavirus test when she thought she might have been exposed. But the nearest COVID-19 testing site is 15 miles away, with no public transportation available. And she doesn't own a car.
Como yo de mi parte, yo ese día tuve que pedir un carro para poder ir a hacerme el test.
Sarai says she borrowed a car from a friend and got her test, which was negative. But she thinks the transportation issue probably prevents others in her town from getting a COVID test when they need one. Early on in the pandemic, University of Illinois anthropologist Gilberto Rosas was struck by how easy it was for him, a work-from-home professor, to get tested, compared to people working nearby on farms and at meat plants, which had big outbreaks.
We walk down 2 flights of stairs, go out the back door, and we can get testing. Whereas these people who are at the forefront, who work in the fields, who work in the plants, they lack that kind of access.
Rosas and his colleagues set out to study what was causing the virus to spread among ag workers. They quickly realized something needed to be done to address this issue of testing access.
We are doctors, but we are not MDs. We are not MDs, we are not nurses. And recognizing what we lacked, we began looking for community partners.
They teamed up with local clinics and began hosting pop-up COVID testing sites in the central Illinois town of Rantoul. They advertised the events in English and Spanish and have tried to use their long-standing community connections to bolster turnout. On a recent Monday afternoon, Rosas stood in a parking lot in the freezing cold, wearing head-to-toe protective gear, alongside clinic staff who screened people arriving for testing. They've been frustrated by low turnout at many testing events. At some, barely more than a dozen people showed up. That could be for a number of reasons, including fear of a positive result. Missing out on 2 weeks of work could be financially devastating, says Diana Tellefson-Torres, who leads the United Farm Workers Foundation based in California.
We're talking about low-wage workers. Every penny counts.
She says in the U.S., there's just not a good safety net for many of these workers.
When you have to worry about putting food on your own table for your family, sometimes that is the focus because there isn't another option.
There's also mistrust and fear, especially among undocumented workers who prefer to fly under the radar. So building trust is critically important, she says, not just to get people to show up for testing, but also for the vaccine. Torres says she's heard from farm workers who are eager to get it, but others have reservations.
One of the big challenges is also like, what is this vaccine? What does it contain? Or what are you putting in my body?
That's something Sarai, the farm worker in Illinois, worries about too. She isn't planning to get the vaccine. She says what she's read online made her worry about adverse reactions. But Sarai says if someone she trusted showed her evidence the vaccine is safe, she could change her mind. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Christine Herman.
That story was co-reported with Harvest Public Media's Dana Cronin in collaboration with Side Effects Public Media and the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting. The Illinois Legislative Black Caucus earlier this month succeeded in pushing legislation that would, among other things, end cash bail. And if signed by the governor, Illinois would be the first state to completely end the use of what is known as money bonds. Reporter Maureen McKinney takes a closer look at the bill.
Levette was arrested on aggravated battery charges 5 years ago following an altercation with her then mother-in-law. Though she was never convicted, she was jailed for more than a year and spent 4 months on home confinement because she could not afford to pay the $25,000 bail. As the case wore on, bail was reduced to $9,500, and it was paid by the Chicago Woman's Family and the Chicago Community Bond Fund. Levette, who we are identifying only by her first name at her request, recently celebrated the General Assembly's adoption earlier this month of a measure that would end cash bail.
This bill or any of the orders that we had that was passed at the time that I was arrested, it could have saved a lot of families from the heartaches that me and my family went through regarding losing housing, losing jobs, and me almost losing my kids.
The measure is wrapped in a far-reaching piece of criminal reform legislation. It had not been signed by Governor Pritzker as of Thursday morning. If he signs it, Illinois will be the first state to completely end the use of cash bail. Supporters say it will ensure that arrestees will not be detained because they can't afford to pay bond. Often those cases are in poor, primarily Black communities. Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox recently spoke in a program for the progressive entity of the appeal. She offered an example. Someone is charged with shoplifting because they've stolen a few hundred dollars of merchandise. They can't afford the $500 bail to get out.
At the same time, we have people who have been charged with first-degree murder and have gotten a bail amount that they could, in fact, afford.
But Jim Durkin, the minority leader of the Illinois House of Representatives and a former prosecutor in Cook County, disagrees.
Public safety is the state's greatest responsibility to its citizens above all. The elimination of cash bail basically says that we respect the honor system for violent criminals and gang members.
The bill, which would take effect in January 2023, if signed, offers dozens of charges that could compel a judge to detain the accused. First-degree murder, arson, gun-related offense, sexual assaults, domestic violence, and other crimes. The director of the Illinois Justice Project is Sherelle Mitchell. The group is part of a coalition that advocated for the end of cash bail. He says the bill maps the process for determining whether someone will be detained.
So in the status quo, we have like a patchwork of laws. Some of them contradict each other.
The bill also requires the Administrative Office of the Illinois Court to regularly collect data on pretrial practices, something that is absent now. Democratic Senator Robert Peters sponsored the bill in his chamber. He says the measure will be financially beneficial for what he calls tough communities, like the Hyde Park neighborhood where he lives.
What Money Bond does is it pulls millions of dollars out of a community. And so working class communities that need food on their table, that need, you know, to pay rent or pay their mortgage, working class communities that need support, just need that money in their pocket, now won't have that money pulled out.
Now it's up to Governor Pritzker. He's lent support to the concept of ending cash bail, but we may not know for months whether he endorses the General Assembly's vision. I'm Maureen McKinney.
Students at college campuses across the country have called on universities to defund and abolish their campus police departments, including at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Education reporter Lee Gaines spent months digging into arrest data, talking with activists and campus cops. Students and faculty who want campus cops gone say reforms won't work, that the police are a racist institution, and that they've targeted black students and community members for years.
When I say officer, y'all say overseer. Officer!
Overseer! About 60 people are gathered outside the police department at the University of Illinois' Urbana campus. They're all wearing masks and carrying pots and pans. They want to send a message to campus police. You're not welcome here. A U of I senior named William Burke is at the mic.
I was skating down Green Street 3 weeks ago. Skateboarding, right? Turn right on 4th. What happens? I get pulled over, and five other cops showed up no shorter than 3 minutes after that. I was skateboarding.
Burke, who is black, was given a warning by campus police that says he ran two red lights. He disputes that. He's also one of many black students on campus who say they're over-policed by UIPD. And here's what the data shows. More than half of people taken to jail by UIPD between 2016 and 2019 were black. But black students make up only about 7% of the U of I student body. And black people make up an estimated 12% of the Champaign-Urbana metro population. Burke says campus police make him feel unsafe, and that's why he's advocating for their removal.
I'm paying this money to go to this school. I'm putting in my time to go here, and then they have cops there to just make me know that even though I go here and this is my school, it's not my place. That's how it feels to me, at least.
Burke started referring to himself as a police abolitionist after George Floyd, a black man, was killed by a white police officer in Minneapolis last May. A lot of students I talked to say that's what propelled them into this movement. And now they want the U of I to take the $8-plus million they spend on police every year and put it into mental health and other services for students. And they're not alone. Students and faculty at campuses across the country, including in Michigan, California, and Connecticut, have staged protests and written letters calling on universities to dismantle their campus police departments. Dylan Rodriguez is a professor at the University of California, Riverside, and he's been a police abolitionist for the last 25 years. He explains the movement this way.
It's a recognition of the foundational violence of an existing system and the need to eliminate it. And it's a collective call to creativity, to remake the world in the absence of that system.
That system being policing, which leaves officers like the chief of UIPD police, Alice Carey, with some very big questions.
People can call to defund police, but what is the alternative? You can't take us away and leave society, you know, without resources.
Rodriguez answers her this way. Police react to crimes after they've happened, while abolitionists want a system focused on giving people the resources they need to prevent crime.
And I'm talking about mass shootings. I'm talking about sexual violence. I'm talking about so-called property crime. There's all different kinds of ways to prevent that stuff from actually happening that then eliminates the need for a reactive police force that gets on the scene when the damage is already done.
Rodriguez says police often make those situations worse. Carrie, the UIPD chief, acknowledges the department can do better. She says they're taking steps to engage with communities of color more and adding social workers to their patrols. But she says campus police are necessary to protect vulnerable populations. Students like Latrell Crawford disagree. He's a Black U of I senior, and when he imagines a police-free campus, he feels safer.
With policing and the stereotypes and, you know, being here, it's hard to do that when you don't even feel safe, like just comfortably walking on the campus. I want to be able to do that freely without, you know, the stereotypes existing, the systems existing that oppress us and marginalize us.
The U of I students plan to continue to agitate. They say they'll host workshops and other events this spring, and they're doing this so that hopefully, one day, all students will feel safe and welcome on campus, regardless of their identity. I'm Lee Gaines, Illinois Newsroom.
Lee also talked with campus police, who say they're necessary to protect the people in their communities and their institutions' assets.
University of Illinois police officer Kyle Krikovich says every night on the job is unique. But on a Friday night late last October, he's called to an incident that captures the spirit of 2020.
So there's a dumpster fire.
It turns out to be a big dumpster fire. Flames lick the side of an adjacent apartment building in Urbana. Krikovich pulls a fire extinguisher out of his squad car. He keeps one there for situations like this. However,
this doesn't happen every day. That's kind of fun.
I'm tagging along with Krikovich to get an idea of what a typical night for campus police officers is like. In addition to the dumpster fire, Krikovich helped a couple students whose car ran out of gas, and he wrote a traffic ticket to a teenage driver during the four late-night hours I spent with him.
I'm definitely giving you a citation again.
Krikovich is in his mid-20s. He's been a campus police officer for nearly 3 years, and he grew up in the area and graduated from the U of I.
This is home. And I want to make sure that everyone that comes here, whether they're from Chicago or they're an international student coming from, you know, China or wherever, that they feel that this is home too and that they can be safe and get the education that they want.
But some students and faculty at the U of I are calling on the institution to defund and disband its campus police force. Here's U of I graduate student Austin Hoffman speaking at a protest last fall.
Instead, what we want is police out of our classrooms, out of our dorms, off our campus, and out of our society.
Activists say people of color are over-policed by campus officers, and data from the department shows that between 2016 and 2019, more than half of the people taken to jail by UIPD were Black. Black students make up only about 7% of the U of I student body, and Black people make up an estimated 12% of the area's metro population. Meanwhile, most of the UIPD officers are white. I asked the chief of UIPD, Alice Carey, why Black people appear to be overrepresented in the arrest data. She says systemic racism in other parts of society, like housing and healthcare, contribute to the high numbers of people of color getting arrested.
You know, we don't dictate who commits crime. It doesn't come with a color. It comes with an act.
University policing has evolved from the watchmen of the late 1800s to looking and acting like city police forces today. That's according to John Sloan. He's a professor emeritus at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, and he studied campus policing for more than two decades. He says campus police often use the same weapons, technology, and training as municipal officers. And Sloan says they're also impacted by systemic racism, and the reforms the departments need are vast.
We've screwed it all up. And so the question then becomes, all right, if we accept that we've screwed it all up, can we fix it? And I think the answer to that is yes.
Sloan says fixing these departments will take a lot of time and resources. Alice Carey, the chief of UIPD, says her department is committed to doing better. She says they've created an outreach team, and she hopes to hire more women and officers of color, among other reforms. But she says,
we're not all out doing the wrong things of what you see on television. There's some very compassionate, empathetic law enforcement professionals that are here to help.
Both Carey and U of I police officer Kyle Krikovich agree that police, including campus officers, are asked to address too many things, from homelessness to mental health.
You know, we do so much. I don't think the right message is defund us. It's work with us. let's find other money to enact that change.
Krikovich says if police weren't responsible for addressing so many of society's and the university community's problems, then maybe you won't need as many officers like him. I'm Lee Gaines, Illinois Newsroom.
Stay with us. We'll have more just ahead on Statewide. We're back on Statewide. On the way, sales have exceeded expectations in the first year of Illinois' recreational marijuana program, but there are still concerns about racial equity. We'll have that story ahead. But first, reporter Lee Gaines spent months talking to students, activists, and campus police. Student abolitionists at the University of Illinois' campus at Urbana-Champaign want the campus police gone. In the final installment of her series, she goes looking for solutions that would satisfy people on both sides of the debate.
Liage Blue Stewart is a Black U of I senior studying theater. He says he feels more threatened by campus police than protected, and he doesn't see the value of the department.
It just seems like they're just here, and for the fact that they have such a large budget that some of the departments in the school actually don't have and actually could use, and it can be more for the students, it's crazy to me.
But the idea that you'd rid a campus of its police force is crazy to a lot of other people, including UIPD Chief Alice Carey.
And if people see what happens, you know, in the streets where people don't care about the human life, then that may change their minds as to why we need law enforcement in today's day and age.
So what are the alternatives? An estimated 95% of all colleges and universities with more than 2,500 students have their own law enforcement agencies. But I struggled to find any that had actually abolished their police forces. I did, however, find two universities that changed the way they approach crime and punishment on campus. Devin Kramer is an assistant dean at the University of Colorado Boulder. Campus officials there say 1,000 students went through the campus's restorative justice program last academic year.
We see not only the benefit in terms of lower recidivism rates, but we actually see benefit in terms of our town and gown relationships in Boulder because of our RJ program.
The program brings students together with those they have harmed and other members of the community to talk through what happened. Then they come to an agreement about how to make it right. Kramer says restorative justice is not a replacement for campus police, but
the more people we can get into a mindset of harm repair instead of punishment, I hope that that would result in systems, you know, improving.
We need something like this that's innovative and it gives alternatives to offenders. And I think it'd be a great idea and a great program to implement here.
That's UIPD Chief Alice Carey. I played some of my conversation with Kramer for her. She says her department is trying to reform in other ways, like adding social workers to patrol units. But she says restorative justice is something she'd like to explore. Scholars and activists say a similar but different type of work is needed to fix systemic problems. It's called transformative justice, and students at the U of I want to establish the practice on their campus. Dara Quiera Amani Beyer is the transformative justice program coordinator at Brown University in Rhode Island.
Transformative justice really exists for communities to solve problems on their own terms in ways that aren't punitive, and that capacity building work and that skill building work can absolutely happen at any point, at any time.
Beyer says the program empowers students to hold people in their communities accountable for their actions outside of institutions like the police. She says it also tries to provide resources to communities to end cycles of violence. U of I senior Liage Stewart is on board with the idea, and he knows that it's going to take students like him thinking outside the box to make it happen.
I mean, the society that we're hoping for is one that we haven't seen before. So that radical imagination is definitely going to have to come into play when we think of ways that we can include everyone.
Stewart doesn't expect campus police to disappear anytime soon. And UIPD Chief Alice Carey says restorative and transformative justice programs won't be created overnight. But the need to find new ways of addressing harm committed on campus is something both the abolitionist and the police officer can agree on. I'm Lee Gaines, Illinois Newsroom.
You're listening to Statewide. Illinois has allowed recreational marijuana for over a year now, and while sales have boomed, the rollout has had its challenges. Among them, the state living up to its promises around racial equity. Eric Schmidt has more.
The first weeks of recreational cannabis sales in Illinois were rocky, to say the least. Eager customers swarmed dispensaries, causing long lines and headaches for surrounding businesses. The dispensaries struggled to keep products in stock, experiencing regular shortages. But those initial kinks have largely resolved, says Bethany Gomez, managing director at Brightfield Group, which tracks the cannabis industry nationally.
You know, there's still some challenges in place, but it's a generally functional market at this point with a pretty robust selection of products.
Gomez says it's impressive, considering Illinois opened its recreational cannabis market only 7 months after the state legalized sales. Illinois' move meant the state immediately saw significant new tax revenue. In 2020, dispensaries sold some $700 million worth of marijuana, and the state and municipalities collected more than $170 million in taxes from those purchases. Gomez says other states, especially ones east of the Mississippi, see Illinois as a potential model.
How quickly Illinois was able to open their doors, open up a recreational market, get taxation revenue in the door, that is a really compelling value proposition for those other states, particularly looking at New York.
But Illinois' young marijuana industry also faces criticism. Most of the organizations benefiting from the first year of legal sales are established cannabis companies with footprints in other states. And Illinois has yet to deliver on its pledge to diversify an industry that's overwhelmingly white and male, and rectify the damage from marijuana criminalization. Gomez says these commitments drew nationwide attention.
It is important for Illinois to make good on those promises because the social equity piece is one of the key differentiators.
The state intends to reach its goals in part by prioritizing applications for cannabis business licenses from people and communities that were harmed by the failed war on drugs. But many of these applicants, who are mostly from Black and brown communities, feel betrayed by state officials.
It was a bait and switch.
Dr. Lawrence Hatchett, who's Black, applied for 10 dispensary licenses with his group, Cannabliss. They didn't win any.
They were talking about investing back into neighborhoods that were greatly affected by war on drugs. They kept emphasizing equity and diversity.
The Marion urologist says the 21 initial finalists for the state's first round of dispensary licenses weren't diverse, and that some had opportunities to fix flaws in their applications. The state hasn't awarded any new dispensary licenses and is now allowing all applicants the chance to improve their submissions and be rescored. But Hatchett isn't optimistic.
Do I think this chance to correct your deficiencies is going to change anything? Absolutely not.
State officials say the delay will produce more minority owners. Outside consultants also took notice. Avis Bulbulian is the CEO of Siva Enterprises, a Los Angeles-based firm that's helped win cannabis licenses in other states with competitive merit-based programs.
You're always going to end up with groups that come up short. It's the nature of the process. Here, there's just a lot of questions that remain unanswered.
Bulbulian advised an Illinois group that wasn't among the initial finalists. He says the state made a mistake when it relied on veteran ownership to distinguish among the top-scoring dispensary applicants.
When you look at what the intent of the act was, it was to benefit groups that are disproportionately impacted by the war on drugs. With the veteran dynamic in this, they just don't qualify in that disenfranchised demographic profile.
Kareem Kenyatta co-founded the Majority Minority Group, which guided some non-white candidates through the application process. He says many minority applicants expected their backgrounds would mean more.
People were under the impression that, you know, if they had a genuine story about being a social equity applicant, they thought that was going to count for more.
Kenyatta says the state is quickly running out of time to make good on its promises to establish cannabis businesses owned by people of color.
If we don't get real social equity applicants that become owner operators, I do think there would be a lot of skepticism and a lot of faith in the program will be lost.
And not just locally. Kenyatta says states across the country are watching to see if Illinois increases minority ownership in 2021. I'm Eric Schmidt.
Thank you.
Like all areas of life, the pandemic has hit small businesses hard. Some estimates show Illinois losing about 4,000 businesses over the last year. But there are still aspiring business owners taking a chance and opening during this time. And women are leading the charge, despite the risks. Michael Puente has more.
Yeah, and I'm thinking of that.
Valerie Hammer is on the phone dealing with a supplier of one of her designer lines at her new women's clothing boutique, Azul, in South Suburban Frankfurt. She's been open barely 2 months.
It's something that I always wanted to do. It's been a passion of mine, and I think it will be a lot of fun.
The boutique is situated in Frankfurt's historic downtown district, with quaint little shops giving it a feel of being far away from the hustle and bustle of downtown Chicago. Hammer says even though many women are working from home these days, they still want to look fashionable.
I sell clothes that you can wear from home, and then I also have the dressier type of clothing for the women who still have to go out, and they're vice presidents of their businesses, realtors that, you know, have to dress accordingly. So I still have those type of clothing.
Despite locally owned businesses taking a hit during the pandemic, more than 2,200 businesses started in Illinois in late December, a 45% increase at the same time in 2019, according to the Census Bureau. Hammer, who is also an accountant, says she's well aware of the pitfalls of starting a business in this economic environment.
I did not put all my eggs in the same basket, and that is what most people do. They overextend themselves. I didn't do any of that. Being an accountant, I'm careful, I'm cautious. I have a regular full-time job as being an accountant of my own business, so this is something in additional.
Hammer continues to run her accounting firm in addition to Azul. She recommends budding entrepreneurs seek out a sort of mentor to help them along. That's also what the state of Illinois recommends.
Illinois Small Business Development Centers, or the SBDCs, located across the state, are a first line of support for entrepreneurs looking to launch or grow their businesses. They provide one-on-one mentoring, counseling, and access to resources at no cost to the business.
That's Christy Dula, a deputy director of the Illinois Department of Commerce, who deals with entrepreneurs. The state is investing $19 million in its small business development centers to help those looking to become their own boss.
We're seeing women, especially women of color, are leading the way with new business starts in the nation, and we're also seeing that in Illinois as well.
Prior to the pandemic, the number of women-owned businesses nationally grew 21% from 2014 to 2019. That percentage more than doubled to 43% for women of color, according to a report by American Express. Dula said the state is seeking new startups in cleaning services and food-based companies, but away from the traditional restaurant setting. Lenora Medellin of Chicago is one of those new business owners seizing the opportunity.
With 2020 being the way it is, people have just said, do whatever you want.
She and her husband, Renee, operate a small catering company on the city's southeast side called The Impeccable Bite. While there are no weddings or big events to cater, Medellin says they are providing meals for much smaller events, like for 2 to 4 people. Medellin worked in catering at a local casino, and her husband is a trained chef.
And we said, you know what, let's just start small, and we'll start making charcuterie platters, which, you know, he makes all the time for family parties.
Medellin says the couple is being careful not to overspend and keeping to a strict budget.
Since my husband does have that chef background, he knows how much product to order and when. So that was also a very big help to us.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you so much. Sure.
Back at Azul Boutique, owner Valerie Hammer encourages aspiring business owners, especially women, not to be scared off by the negative headlines.
I would say do it. Follow your dreams. That's the only way you're going to be fulfilled as an individual, as a person, as a woman, and inspire other women. And if you're thinking of opening up a business, I say speak to an accountant.
Hammer says she can recommend a good one. Michael Puente, WBEZ News.
That wraps up this week statewide. Join us next time. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. If you missed any of our show, find it and links to the stories featured at our website at statewideshow.com. You can also like us on Facebook and find our weekly podcasts through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.